To record that, and the recording is starting right now. Okay, so first of all, I just want to welcome all of you, and I want to say a little word about the co-sponsors of this event, of this webinar today. First of all, I want to recognize Baltimore Yearly Meeting, the Peace and Social Concerns Committee, and in particular, I want to thank Bob Rudy, who's on the call. And Bob is the co-clerk of that committee. That's clerk is a Quaker term for chairperson. So he and I are the co-clerks of that committee, and it's a multi-state committee of Quakers. So we're really pleased that Baltimore Yearly Meeting Peace and Social Concerns Committee is sponsoring this webinar. I also want to send a shout out to Homewood Friends Meeting in Baltimore, which is my home meeting, for putting a large banner out front that says nuclear weapons are now illegal. One of the reasons that we decided to do this webinar is because very few people who aren't already activists don't even know about the treaty, and if they do know about it, they don't know what it means or why it's important. My meeting suggested that we do this, which I thought was a great idea. So this is designed for people who want to learn more about that. The other people that are co-sponsors of our webinar today are Maryland Peace Action, and Max Obachevsky is from Maryland Peace Action, and he'll be helping me today with the tech issues and also with the Q&A that we're going to have. And I want to recognize Dr. Gwen Dubois, who is the president of Chesapeake Physicians for Social Responsibility. And also she's the chair of Prevent Nuclear War Maryland, both of which are co-sponsors. We're delighted that the Maryland Poor People's Campaign is co-sponsoring this event with us. We've been developing a relationship with them, and we think that they're a really important group, and we're really pleased that they're with us today. Massachusetts Peace Action is also a co-sponsor, and I want to say hello to Cole Harrison, who is on the call. And we in Maryland, we consider MAPA, as it's known, Massachusetts Peace Action, to be one of the best Peace Action affiliates in the country. And we always look to them for guidance to see what they're doing, and are delighted to be able to co-sponsor this with them. And then Casa Baltimore LeMay is another sponsor. And if I've forgotten anyone, please accept my deepest apologies. So welcome to everyone. And the agenda is that I'm going to introduce Dr. Gerson, then he's going to show us a slideshow that he's put together just for us, and talk about the treaty and the background to the development of that treaty, and why it's important, even if the U.S. isn't a signatory to it, and how we can use it to rid the world of nuclear weapons. So let me introduce Dr. Gerson. And I'm just going to do an abbreviated introduction, because if I told you all of the things that he's done, we would be here all morning. He's an incredible activist, an incredible scholar. He's done an amazing amount of things that are all important in his life. He's currently president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security. He's also vice president of the International Peace Bureau. He was co-founder of the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy. And again, I'm leaving off a lot of things. He helped to launch the nuclear weapons freeze movement of the 1980s, and many, many other things. He plays a leading role today in collaborations among US, Asian, and European peace and nuclear weapons abolition movements. He's a frequent keynote speaker at world conferences. And he's written several books, one of which is Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World. So we are incredibly fortunate to have someone like Dr. Gerson or Joseph to lead this webinar. And so, Joseph, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Screen share. Give me a second here with the screen share. It's not what it's doing, not doing what it's supposed to do. Can people see that?
No.
Okay. We had it before, it was working perfectly in our preparation. Hold on just a second, I apologize. Here we go, I think. I'm seeing everything but what I want to see here. Screens, that's not what I want. This is ridiculous. Excuse me. Cole knows that I'm an absolute tech genius.
Maybe Jean has to say screen share. Maybe
no, I've got screen share on. I really apologize for this. I've got it on here.
Maybe Jean, if you make him a co-host, that might help.
I think I did. Let me try it again. He is a co-host.
I've got it. Here we go. Okay, we should be all right now.
Yes.
Okay, I apologize for that delay. I want to start just by thanking Jean for the invitation to join. It's a pleasure also to be seeing a number of friends online here. Colleagues from Mass Peace Action, Tim and Wallace, who's an indefatigable campaigner for the TPNW, friends like Max, who goes back to APSC days more decades ago than probably each of us want to think about, and David Boris, who I worked with some years ago in demonstrations in Chicago. So just to appreciate it. I want to say that I've got really the greatest respect and appreciation for Jean and for Maryland Peace Action, who do just really such exceptional work. And happy that Jean is involved in organizing a conference we're doing up here based out of Massachusetts on no first use policies, which we think maybe can be won under the Biden administration. As I begin, let me warn you, I've got to do two things at once here. Here we go. We only have to go down this way. As I begin, I want to warn you that you may get a little more nuclear diplomatic history than you anticipated, but that's essential for understanding the global forces that led to the TPNW's negotiation and why we have such an urgent need to remove the existential nuclear threat. On Friday, January 22nd, people in cities and towns across the United States and around the world celebrated the entry into force of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW. Church bells were rung, webinars were organized, and mass demonstrators keeping safe distances stood outside the Oak Ridge Nuclear Weapons Complex, companies involved in the manufacture of nuclear weapons, and in city and town squares across the country, holding banners that celebrated the treaty's entry into force. These gatherings online and elsewhere stood in sharp contrast to the electric sense of fear felt by policymakers and others that President Trump might push the nuclear button in the immediate aftermath of his failed coup. With President Trump facing possible criminal conviction and terminal bankruptcy and having the power to initiate nuclear war on his own authority, Nancy Pelosi had good reason to press Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, to ensure that the president couldn't take us all with him as he went down. For several days, headlines focused on the possible imminent danger of nuclear war. Hopefully this increased consciousness will facilitate our organizing and advocacy in the coming weeks and months. For decades, absent such desperate circumstances, many world leaders and policymakers have understood that accidents and miscalculations, including the belief that nuclear war can be won, could lead to catastrophe, and they urged action to eliminate nuclear weapons. A dozen times before the Cuban Missile Crisis, during the Korean War, and crises related to Berlin, Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Middle East, many of them reinforced by Eisenhower's massive retaliation nuclear warfighting doctrine. In these circumstances, U.S. presidents prepared and or threatened to initiate nuclear war. And in the period leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis, atmospheric nuclear weapons tests had killed Marshall Islanders, Japanese fishermen, poisoned much of Japan's food supply, and also so-called U.S. atomic vets. Strontium-90 was found in the milk that people drank and in children's teeth. This down here. In 1961, the year before President Kennedy and Soviet Premier Khrushchev went eyeball to eyeball during the Cuban Missile Crisis, speaking from the dais of the UN General Assembly, Kennedy warned that, quote, every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident, miscalculation, or by madness. The weapons of war, he said, must be abolished before they abolish us. Since 1962, during international crises and wars, on at least 24 occasions, US presidents have prepared and or threatened to initiate nuclear war. On September 11th, 2001, during the Iraq wars, and in the run-up to the nuclear deal with Iran, and most recently with Trump's fire and fury threats and war preparations against North Korea. Similarly, leaders of each of the other 8 nuclear weapon states has made similar threats at least once. Human survival indeed hangs from the slenderest of threads, a reality confirmed by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists expert panel, who have set their doomsday clock at 100 seconds to midnight, the closest to catastrophe since the clock was created in 1953 at the height of the Cold War. Let's see where I am here, hold on. Even short of a massive exchange that would inflict omnicidal, which is to say wiping out all human beings, omnicidal nuclear war, we now know that even a smaller nuclear exchange of 50 to 100 nuclear weapons, not only say between the US and China, but between India and Pakistan, could take the lives of as many as 2 billion people. In addition to the many millions killed in the nuclear explosions and near-term radioactive fallout, smoke resulting from the fires would spread across the Northern Hemisphere, blocking sunlight for as long as a decade, resulting in crop failures and famine far worse than any in human history so far. During the 75 years since the unnecessary and indiscriminate atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which by today's International Court of Justice standards would be considered crimes against humanity, A-bomb survivors, scientists and physicians, scholars, community-based activists, diplomats, and many national leaders have worked to prevent apocalypse and to create a nuclear weapons-free world. A high point came in 1970 with the entry into force of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This seminal treaty was a grand bargain made between the nuclear haves and have-nots. In exchange for the nuclear weapons states, non-nuclear weapons states, those without nuclear weapons, forswearing development and possession of nuclear weapons, nuclear powers recognized the right to generate nuclear power for peaceful purposes, which was a grave mistake, and in Article 6 committed to engage in good faith negotiations for the complete elimination of their nuclear arsenals. Refusing to compromise on their omnicidal power, for example, their failure to implement the 13 steps agreed at the 2000 NPT review conference, and bowing to the interests of their respective military industrial complexes, the good faith negotiations never occurred. India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea have since become nuclear powers, thus increasing the threats to human survival. Quantitative and qualitative nuclear arms races have also followed, with the United States now on track to spend up to $2 trillion to replace the entire nuclear arsenal and its delivery systems. That would keep the United States as a nuclear power, you know, throughout the century. Concerned about the prospects for human survival, and with the nuclear powers refusing to take meaningful steps year after year to fulfill their Article 6 commitments, countries as diverse as Sweden, South Africa, Ireland, and Mexico, which were outraged and disgusted, I mean, literally disgusted, by US, Russian, and other intransigence, sought a means to break through the nuclear powers' rationale that nuclear security concerns and the need to maintain nuclear deterrence required the maintenance of modernization of their nuclear arsenals. In 2013, many of the non-nuclear weapons states found their way to the obvious alternative paradigm, to focus on what nuclear weapons do to people and the initiation of a series of related international conferences. I was privileged to attend two of the three humanitarian conferences called the conferences on the humanitarian consequences of nuclear war. The first was held in Oslo in 2013. Diplomats from 127 nations, as well as civil society activists, gathered there to learn what nuclear weapons do to people and about the dangers they represent. I mean, this may seem to be common sense for us, but so many people just have no, even diplomats, had so little knowledge. At least on the sidelines, there were also discussions about what new actions could be taken to advance the prospect of fulfilling the NPT's Article 6 good faith negotiations promise. At the second conference, held in the following year in Nayarit, Mexico, with all the nuclear powers absent except North Korea, conference organizers felt free to begin the conference with testimonies by Hiroshima and Nagasaki A-bomb survivors. They described their suffering, losses, and the literal hell on earth that they had witnessed. And they repeated their fundamental truth that human beings and nuclear weapons cannot coexist. PowerPoint presentations by representatives of the International Committee of the Red Cross and Chatham House in London demonstrated why no institution anywhere in the world can meaningfully respond to the massive death and destruction that would be inflicted by a single nuclear weapons detonation in a city. The most telling moment in Nayarit, for me at least, came when, after hearing testimonies and details about nuclear weapons modernizations and nuclear warfighting doctrines, a young African diplomat, I wish I had a picture of this, a young African diplomat rose, and with his pleading arms outstretched, he cried out, "What are these people thinking?" Another striking and controversial moment came when Angela Kane, the UN High Representative for Disarmament, rose to say that ultimately all roads to nuclear weapons-free world lead through the NPT. More than a few nuclear abolitionists, long disgusted with the failure of the NPT to deliver on its Article 6 promise, rose and literally howled their outrage at her. But she held her ground, and over time, the nuclear powers have claimed that the TPNW undermines the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the diplomats who ultimately negotiated the 2017 treaty have been clear that it complements and reinforces the seminal 1970 treaty. Another memory from Nayarit, for me, was having breakfast with Setsuko Thurlow, the brilliant and indomitable Hiroshima Hibakusha, who since became the co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize for her work in support of the TPNW. While I raised concerns that the great powers' dependence on their nuclear arsenals may lead the TPNW to be no more than a parallel to the NPT, minus the engagement of nuclear weapon states, Setsuko was steadfast in her belief that it could lead to nuclear weapons-free world provide the essentials for human survival. The driving force behind the third Humanitarian Consequences Conference, which was held in a Viennese palace, was Austria's disarmament ambassador, Alexander Kemet. I just think having a disarmament ambassador, what that means about the structure of the state and ambitions. The summer before, he had been deeply moved and influenced by Hibakusha testimonies, A-bomb survivors, during the World Conference Against A&H Bombs in Nagasaki. At the very least, he was determined to ensure that there was momentum for continued disarmament diplomacy in the months leading up to the 2015 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference at the UN. The role that the Hibakusha played then and so many other times underlines how central they have been to the TPNW and other disarmament initiatives since the very early 1950s. Got lost here, hold on. See Kemet there in the middle, hit the wrong button. The outcome of the third and final Humanitarian Consequences Conference held in Vienna in December 2014 was sealed shortly after it began. Following opening statements came the testimonies of Setsuko Thurlow and an Australian Maori who described the deadly impacts of uranium mining. These framed the conference, but the coup de grace came from an American woman, Michelle Thomas, who was assisted onto the stage in her wheelchair. Beginning with a heart-rending cry, "My government has killed me!" And in her passionate and stream of consciousness extemporaneous speech, she explained how fallout from nuclear weapons testing, underground as well as atmospheric, had sickened her with cancer and taken the lives of many patriotic and unquestioning citizens in St. George, Utah. After her harrowing speech, no one in the palace hall was left unmoved, with many in tears. The pathetic rebuttal by the US ambassador was painfully embarrassing, leaving most of us wanting to crawl under our chairs just in embarrassment. A slight digression, let me give you a slight digression here. It's worth noting that the Machow Cowboy, and in this case, Genghis Khan, movie star John Wayne, also died as a result of nuclear weapons testing fallout that made its way to St. George, a town in the midst of the state's most beautiful red rocks and the background for the filming of many Westerns. While filming the movie The Conqueror in 1956, testing fallout blew across St. George, poisoning Wayne, his leading lady, Susan Hayward, director Dick Powell, and dozens of other cast members of the film who ultimately died from cancer. You know, one of the things that I found over the years is that people here in the United States have essentially no understanding of how the nuclear weapons production cycle, testing and so on, has poisoned and killed so many Americans. And my experience has been that in putting the US downwinders and Native Americans who've been devastated by uranium mining, putting them before US audiences is just absolutely transforming. Back to Vienna. Following speech after speech by the assembled diplomats, the conference concluded with the Austrian government's pledge, drafted by Ambassador Kemet, which was joined by nearly all the participating states. It reiterated the risks posed by nuclear weapons, described what it termed as the quote, legal gap for the prohibition and elimination of nuclear weapons that must be filled, which is to say to hold the nuclear weapons powers accountable to Article 6 of the NPT. And the statement urged governments to join Austria in taking action to reduce the dangers of nuclear war. That appeal led to the convening in 2017 of negotiations at the United Nations. There, in an unusually collaborative spirit, diplomats for the non-nuclear weapon states, assisted by civil society experts like John Burroughs, a friend to many of us, of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, by Hibakusha and others, they debated and drafted the treaty's terms. In the end, the promulgation of the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons was done by 122 governments, none of them nuclear weapon states. Having since secured the necessary ratifications, the treaty entered into force on January 22nd. It has been opposed by the nuclear weapon states and their military allies, some of whom did all that they could to prevent other nations from signing and ratifying the treaty. The TPNW further stigmatizes and undermines the perceived legitimacy of nuclear weapons and is designed to reinforce the NPT. It prohibits the development, production, manufacture, acquisition, possession, stockpiling, transferring, stationing, installation, and the threat to use nuclear weapons. Among its most important articles are those that forbid non-nuclear weapon states to assist the nuclear activities of the nuclear powers. For example, refueling nuclear capable bombers. There's a mandate in the treaty to assist nuclear weapons victims, which is important. And there's a requirement that treaty nations, quote, encourage states not party to the treaty to sign, ratify, accept, approve, or accede to the treaty. Encouragement could take many forms, lobbying government officials, funding nuclear disarmament activists, discouraging investment from corporations and financial institutions involved in the production of nuclear weapons, and ultimately, maybe even sanctions. As we promote the treaty and our and other disarmament initiatives, I think we have to be careful about the claims that we make. Many of the treaty's most active and enthusiastic supporters celebrated that the TPNW makes nuclear weapons illegal. This is true in part. The treaty being international law, it applies to all states that have signed and ratified it. Standing outside of the treaty, as the United States does, means that it does not apply to nuclear weapons or umbrella states at this time. There are no guarantees that the TPNW will move the nuclear powers, all of which are now spending vast fortunes to upgrade their nuclear arsenals and their delivery systems, and whose political systems, like ours here in the United States, are deeply influenced by the military-industrial complexes. The authors of the Prohibition Treaty understand that there is no shortcut, right page here, that there's no shortcut to universalizing the treaty. They know that the road to the nuclear weapons-free world is a long and difficult one. They are well aware that the leverage of most nations that have signed and ratified the treaty, for example, the Comoros and Trinidad and Tobago, is limited. While we here in the United States take inspiration and encouragement from the TPNW, and while activists, including Tim and Wallace, who's on this call, are pressing states like Massachusetts to adopt legislation mandating studies about what the states would need to do to be in compliance with the treaty, over the next several years, the most critically important campaigning will be done in the so-called nuclear umbrella states. These are NATO nations, Japan, and other Asian Pacific countries, and Russian-dominated Commonwealth independent states, which are functionally protectorates that rely on the US and Russian nuclear arsenals. Should one or more of these dependent states break ranks by signing and ratifying the treaty, it will threaten to unravel the political framework that upholds the world's nuclear disorder. This possibility is not far-fetched. Polls indicate that 70% of the Japanese people want their government to sign the TPNW. And later tonight, in one of the seminal Japanese peace movement events, their Bikini Day commemoration, the focus will be on winning government support of the TPNW. There's also Australia's Labor Party, which supports the treaty and was just barely defeated in the country's 2019 election. In the Netherlands, a parliamentary majority voted in favor of the treaty, though their government continues to refuse joining the treaty. And debates continue in other NATO nations. Those of us here who are horrified by the specter of humanitarian consequences of the nuclear weapons and who understand the urgency of nuclear disarmament, we have our work cut out for us. We can't forget the fear of Trump's last two unhinged weeks in office and Nancy Pelosi pleading with the Pentagon not to implement an order to initiate nuclear war in the case of our unhinged president and his proximity to the nuclear football. In addition to doing all that we can to preserve constitutional democracy, to stanch the pandemic, and to support revitalization of our economy, we must hold President Biden's feet to the fire. With the New START Treaty now extended, a priority has to be rejoining the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran. Biden previously stated his opposition to US first use nuclear warfighting, that's the policy that has provided the foundation for repeated and very dangerous US nuclear blackmail. You saw the list earlier. Among other things, first use is a doctrine that could lead to miscalculations and use them or lose them missile launches by US rivals. With Senators Markey and Warren, Representatives Liu and Smith, and others introducing no first use legislation, we need to urge other members of Congress to sign on. Even if the legislation doesn't pass, each additional endorsement will add pressure on Biden to either declare no first use commitment or to include it in the coming nuclear posture review. Biden has sworn to protect the US people, and that must include ensuring that we do not succumb to the existential threat posed by nuclear weapons and preparations for nuclear war. There are other important nuclear disarmament initiatives that we need to be a part of. As we look for the funds to revitalize our pandemic ravaged economy and country, and as the Poor People's Campaign reminds us of the urgent need to end poverty and address urgent human needs, we should be encouraging the President and Congress to call off the plan to spend up to $2 trillion to replace the country's nuclear arsenal and its delivery systems. Two places we can begin are by nixing funding to replace the Pentagon's ground-based ICBMs and the standoff cruise missiles, which undermine rather than augment our real security. In all of this, the TPNW plays an encouraging role and provides us an important opening. Human survival could well depend on our taking advantage of it. So I hope I didn't speak too fast. I hope that there's something in there for each of you, and I look forward to our Q&A.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Joseph, for this great overview. So what we're going to do now is we're going to have Q&A, so you can ask whatever your questions are. So as I said earlier, what we would like to do is try to do it this way, since we have so many people on the call. Put your questions to Joseph in the chat. You should have a little icon at the bottom for chat. If you have a small screen like I do and the chat doesn't come up, you can click on more, which is on the right, and then you'll see that there's a button for chat. And so you can click on that, and then you can write your questions. And so Max Obuchevsky is going to review your questions. And I mean, he's going to read the questions to Joseph, and then Joseph can answer it. And I just want to say one last thing, which is that what has become really significant to me is the statement. Actually, I'm not quite sure who said this, but someone who's very well informed, that with respect to nuclear weapons, it's as long as we have them, it's not a question of if they'll be used, but when they'll be used. And that is very frightening. It may be that they will be used as in the event of an accident or intentionally, but whatever method, it will lead to the deaths of millions, maybe billions of people, and possibly the destruction of life on Earth as we know it. So this is incredibly important. And I want to thank Joseph again for this really good overview. Max, do you have any questions?
People are sort of slow on this, so I'm going to start with this one question I raised with you, Gene. Joe, could you get a little more specific on the difference between signatories and countries that have ratified, if there is a difference?
I'm sorry, Max, you broke up a little bit. Can you repeat the question?
Could you explain the difference between countries that are signatories and countries that have ratified? Is there a difference? From what I heard you say, there is no difference, but I think there is. So could you clarify that?
Sure. So there's a diplomatic process here. There's a diplomatic process, Max, whereby the first step that a country takes to join a treaty is to sign off on the treaty. For example, the United States signed on to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. But there's a second step, which is the ratification, which is the formal adoption of the treaty. And in our case, this gets done by a vote of two-thirds of the members of the Senate. So each country that signed it then has to go through the process of ratifying it. At last count, I think there were 54 countries that have ratified it. Timon will know the number who have signed. I think it's on the order of about 70 or so. For every country, their combination of their political process makes it easier or more difficult for them to move through that process. There's also the reality of the global diplomatic environment, where you know, have the United States, Russia, other nuclear powers in this case, pressing on their countries, saying, "Well, look, if you sign it, there's going to be consequences that you may not want." So you know, you have to go through a political process like that. So even countries that have signed it will not necessarily ratify it, but at this point, most have.
This is okay, a question from Stan Becker. Okay. Jean, should I ask the question, or did you want to say
Max,
something?
Max, you're not very clear. Maybe I better do the questions because you keep breaking up for some reason. I'm just going to. I'll do it because I don't know why you're breaking up. So here's a question for you, Joseph. Dr. Gerson, would you please summarize the factors that determine how close we are to nuclear conflict, which is now 100 seconds to midnight?
Sure. So it's worth it. You know, people can Google the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the Doomsday Clock, and you can watch the ceremony and the talks that were given to provide the explanation for why they, in this case, left the clock's hands set at 100 seconds to midnight. They first moved it this close last year. Factors are many. One of them is simply the reality that the nuclear weapon states are engaged in nuclear arms races now. In ways that they haven't been for some years. And this obviously increases the threat. Also, interestingly, both last year and this, with somewhat different words, they talked about the growing number of authoritarian governments. They basically were pointing toward the political crisis here in the United States, initially focusing on Trump, but January 6th did not help build confidence in decision making here and who controls the nuclear football. Interestingly, again, over the last couple of years, really for the first time, they've brought in the consideration of the climate emergency. And so, you know, they're increasingly looking at the integration of the two, threatening human survival. So I think those are the principal reasons.
Okay, thank you. So Joseph, Stephen Slaner asks how we can use the Bann Treaty as an organizing tool.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, and others may want to chime in here. You know, here in Massachusetts, it was used, you know, the entry into force on the 22nd of January was used as an opportunity to do webinars, to alert the communities through ringing church bells. And when you approach a church to ring its church bells, right, you're doing some education, you're bringing some people in there. Similarly, you know, with standouts. So we have those. My sense, and we have, as I mentioned, there's the effort in the state legislature, which, you know, behind that requires real organizing, to try to move the state to take, or to at least identify what actions it would need to take in order to be acting consistent with the treaty, should the United States ever sign on to it. And you know, that involves education of members of the state legislature, some of whom may go on to be members of Congress, but it requires, you know, and Cole has been doing really great work in terms of trying to build foundations to move progressive legislation through the Massachusetts state legislature. It requires doing the education and organizing in our communities to push it forward. And what I've tried to do, including with this speech, has been to use the treaty to help people understand, on the one hand, the urgency of nuclear disarmament, but also to understand the kind of isolation that we have here in the United States, not understanding the kind of outrage and pressures that have been building in the majority of nations in the world. And there are ways in which, you know, I have great respect for the law of unintended consequences. I don't know how many people on this call have friends or family in some of the NATO nations or in Japan or in Australia. But if you do, writing to them, encouraging them to take action in their countries where there's the hope, the possibility that they can move their governments to sign and ratify the treaty, that's important and shouldn't be underestimated.
Okay, Joseph, we have a question here. Do you see any possibility of linking up the anti-nuclear and climate movements?
I would say it's not only a possibility, it's a requirement. It's not necessarily easy, but it's essential. On the one hand, even a single nuclear weapon is going to devastate the climate. And so there's a coincidence of interest there. You know, the other reality, this is something I'm working on at the moment, is that, we're in a new Cold War with China. It is the driving force at the moment behind much U.S. military spending and much of the development of new nuclear weapons delivery systems and related high-tech weaponry. And this in turn is pushing the Chinese to consider or maybe to be slightly increasing the size of their nuclear arsenal. That's a real danger. And we have the danger, which most people in this country are totally unaware of the really provocative engagements going on between US and Chinese military forces in the South China Sea, parts of which are also known as the West Philippine Sea, which has really become the geopolitical center of the struggle for world power, and around Taiwan. And while both countries are putting their energies into preparations for nuclear holocaust, it also means that they're not doing the collaborations that are needed to stanch climate change. So we need to understand the absolute integration of these issues and find ways to build on it. At the moment, with another organization I'm involved in, the Committee for Sane U.S. China Policy, we're looking at doing our next webinar focused on the possibility of cooperation between the United States and China on climate change. I think it's also part of the narrative as we talk about cooperation with China, even as we may criticize a number of its policies. It also creates the environment here where we're thinking more about cooperation rather than nuclear annihilation.
Okay, Joseph, here's another question. Wait a minute. It says, you didn't mention how the treaty potentially impacts the companies involved mm-hmm. in this business, mm-hmm. many of whom have operations, not to mention investors, in mm-hmm. the countries that have already ratified. Since mm-hmm. these companies are ones lobbying Congress and the president to keep these suicidal weapons indefinitely, can we put pressure on these same companies here in the U.S. through divestment campaigns, et cetera?
Yeah, so I did briefly mention divestment in looking at the range of actions that other states can take. And we know that we have divestment movements going on here in the United States. Again, Timon will have a more comprehensive understanding of actions that took place all across the country on January 22nd. But among them was a protest here in Cambridge at one of the nuclear weapons producers. There's also, I know, some hopes that the foreign governments may adopt legislation or laws that prohibit investment in these companies. We'll have to see if that really takes place. If you're a member of a labor union with a pension fund, if you your town has got investments in these companies, we can organize to reduce that. That strategy also has the benefit of requiring education. So, for example, if your religious denomination has investments in one of these companies, you know, starting to do the work in your local congregation to educate and adopt a resolution to go through the system is a way to kind of build the support that can lead in ways to broader kinds of disarmament initiatives. I think also one thing I do want to point out around the funding, you know, and to appreciate that the Poor People's Campaign is a co-sponsor of this event. You know, the Poor People's Campaign has adopted its moral budget, which calls for cutting U.S. military spending by $300 billion. You know, this is the kind of thing we need to support. You know, we live in an absolutely militarized culture. Not only the production of the weapons themselves, but what that does culturally to the formation of consciousness here. And you know, as we can undermine that, and look at our real security, which is health, housing, food, building the kind of economic infrastructure that that our children and our grandchildren need for economic security in the future. That's where real security lies, and that's where our money should go.
Here's a question or a comment. He says, it's important to note that nuclear weapons have actually been used several times in history, not just at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Just the same as if a robber points a gun at a victim and demands money, he has used a gun. Could you talk a little bit about nuclear weapons being used as a threat?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and could you relate? I mean, could you relate that to how that might affect efforts around no first use?
Yeah, absolutely. So that quotation about the pointing the gun at the head of a victim, you know, that comes from Daniel Ellsberg, who remarkably at age 30 was the primary author of U.S. warfighting doctrine. So he's sharing that from out of his lived experience. So, you know, as I said in the talk, now on more than 30 occasions, the United States has done just that, and this is made possible by having a first strike doctrine and a military that's built around that doctrine. So we can go back as early as 1946, in the aftermath of go back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the weapons were actually detonated. You know, the primary purpose, the determinative purpose for those A-bombings was to bring the war to an immediate end, in order to ensure the United States didn't have to share authority and control over northern China, Manchuria, and Korea. You know, the Eisenhower opposed the A-bombing. Leahy, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, opposed it because they knew Japan was defeated. But the determinative reason was, you know, for imperial purposes. A few years later, I think maybe in 46, there was a crisis with Iran. The United States during the war had essentially allowed the Soviets to have a primary influence in Iran, so that it could serve as a pipeline for the U.S. to supply Russia and the Soviets with weapons. I mean, we don't really think much about this point, but you know, the United States and the Soviet Union were allies against the Nazis. And at the end of the war, the Soviets were slow to withdraw and ease up their pressure in Iran. And so according to his memoirs, Truman says that he invited the Soviet ambassador into the White House and told them that if the Soviet withdrawal from Iran did not begin within 48 hours, Moscow would cease to exist. The withdrawal began in 24 hours. You had the Berlin crisis in 48, but then you looked, I mean, the Korea has been a site of repeated U.S. nuclear threats and preparations for nuclear war. You know, the reason that MacArthur was relieved of duty, and this wasn't widely known, was that he wanted to basically drop nuclear weapons across the along the North Korean border, which the U.S. had seized at that point, with China. He wanted to, as he said, create a radioactive belt of radioactive cobalt across that border, which would basically prevent China from coming in for the next 50 years. And there were repeated preparations and threats to bring the war to an end. Truman lost faith that he could control MacArthur and believed that MacArthur might drop the bomb before Truman authorized it. And that's why he was ousted. Early history here, but you come to the election in 1952. The United States was still at war with North Korea. China had become involved. There were negotiations to end the war were stalled. And so Eisenhower, running for president, said he had a secret plan to end the war. What was his secret plan? To let it be known to the Chinese that if they didn't accept US terms, that he would use nuclear weapons against China. He came to power, he made the threat, and the armistice agreement was arrived at in 1953. Remember that Nixon was the vice president at that point, and Nixon took a lesson from that. So some of you will remember that in 1969, the United States was deep into the process of losing the Vietnam War. Nixon had run for president. I'm looking at the age of people here on the call. Many of you will remember this. Remember, Nixon ran on the promise that he had a secret plan to end the war. He wouldn't say what it was. Well, as Haldeman, who was his chief of staff, later wrote, the secret plan was in fact implemented. It was to drop the word in a number of different ways to the Vietnamese, the Chinese, and the Russians, that if the North Vietnamese didn't accede to our demands, Nixon's a madman. We can't control him. He's got the nuclear button. And so beginning in October of 1969, in a way that was not the formal DEFCOM process of raising the alert and preparations for nuclear war, Nixon mobilized U.S. nuclear forces across the world, flying nuclear-armed B-52s along the Russian border, even putting nuclear weapons in SAC bases in ways that the Russians could see, but also even putting nuclear weapons into civilian airports, like here at Logan in Massachusetts. That nuclear threat and that gamesmanship continued for 29 days. The possibility of accident became so great that the military finally pressed on Nixon to say, look, you've got to call off this threat. You've got to downgrade it. Interestingly, this is the time when the threat was used. The gun was pointed at the head and the Vietnamese refused to flinch. They stuck it out. It was a failed threat. It was a similar earlier threat in 1954 during the siege of Dien Bien Phu. The French being on the brink of defeat by the Vietnamese nationalists and revolutionaries. And in that moment, Eisenhower and Dulles via Nixon made an offer to the French that we could use two nuclear weapons to break the siege of Dien Bien Phu. And the French, as bad as they were, had the wisdom to say, it might not be a good idea. You never know which way the wind blows. That could wipe out all their troops too. And interestingly, you had similar preparations made during the siege of Khe Sanh, which was what, in 1967 by Johnson in Vietnam. You go to the Middle East, and there, it's probably been the nuclear threats were used more in the Middle East than anywhere else. I first became aware of it in 1973. Threats had been made during the Suez Crisis in 56, again in 58 during the revolution in Iraq and the uprising in this near civil war in Lebanon at that point. You know, the October War, the Israeli-Arab War, had been fought, and there was a ceasefire. I was at that point after the Vietnam War. I was working in Europe, and I think I was in Denmark staying with friends, and they were listening to Armed Forces Radio, and Armed Forces Radio announces that U.S. forces are on a nuclear alert, and I'm shocked. I mean, the war is ostensibly over. There's a ceasefire, and I thought, well, maybe it relates to Watergate. Maybe Nixon is trying a coup. I called friends back in the States, and they thought I was being ridiculous. Only that we learned later that Secretary of Defense Schlesinger had basically issued an order that there would be no significant troop movements without his express authorization, trying to prevent Nixon from doing what Trump tried to do last month. In any event, what you learn later is that there had been basically a secret agreement between Golda Meir and Henry Kissinger, in which there was a ceasefire, but the U.S. would turn a blind eye to the Israelis constantly moving the ceasefire line ever closer to Cairo. And the Israeli forces had surrounded and isolated the Egyptian Third Army. They were denying it food and water. And so having already lost the war, the Egyptians were facing both the humiliation and the devastation of losing an entire army. And so on a given night, Sadat sent a message to both the Kissinger, and Nixon was totally drunk at this point and given Watergate. So Kissinger was running things. He sent a message to both Kissinger and to the Soviet leaders saying the next day he was going to go to the UN and ask for their intervention. Well, Kissinger had been trying to negotiate, kind of manipulate the war and its outcome in a way that would maximize, increase US power and influence in the Middle East. So he was not happy with this idea that maybe the Soviets would come in the next day and take some of the influence. So it was Kissinger who ordered that nuclear alert. And at the same time, he ordered Golda Meir to finally respect the ceasefire agreement. And these kind of threats had been made repeatedly. I mean, in both of the Bush-Iraq wars, in Bush senior and Bush the lesser, in the period leading up to the war, when the U.S. was gathering forces, say, in Kuwait, a very explicit threat was made to Iraq that if they attacked our gathering forces with chemical weapons or otherwise, that we would respond with nuclear weapons. So it was used in those cases, it was used in a way that apparently worked. Given the horrors of the Trump years, given the horrors of the Trump years, we want to think in generous terms about Obama in critical ways. But we need to remember that in the lead up to the deal with Iran, Obama and his minions repeatedly said that that all options were on the table in relationship to Iran's nuclear program. When a nuclear power says all options are on the table, they're talking about more than a diplomatic initiative. And then, of course, we had Trump's fire and fury, a threat against North Korea. You read the wordings there. The language was quite clear that he was threatening nuclear attacks. So this has been used repeatedly, and I think it, among other things, it underlines the importance of winning a no first use doctrine. No first use doctrine is not going to bring us to nirvana. It's not going to eliminate nuclear dangers and nuclear threats, but it does remove the ability to proactively threaten nuclear attack in order to maintain basically U.S. empire. And yeah, again, I remember being, during the Vietnam War, I was young and just beginning to learn about the world and to do organizing. Some of our elders would say, look, Vietnam is not an aberration. They didn't always explain what that meant. But what it meant was, you know, the United States has been an empire. We've been an empire, an overseas empire, since 1898. And, you know, Eisenhower's doctrine of massive retaliation was basically done to reinforce the empire. It was cheaper to threaten nuclear annihilation against potential rivals than to maintain the kind of World War II level of conventional forces around the world. And so we need to understand the very deep relationship between nuclear weapons and empire, and then to understand how empire has not really served the US people, right? And we need to be thinking about, you know, where is real security, which lies not in investment in a military budget that equals what the next eight biggest military spenders in the world combined, more than three times of China's, and to be moving to another term that people may not be familiar with, move toward common security diplomacy with other nations. And we can go into common security, but just to say that was the paradigm which led to the INF Treaty, in 1987, and really ended the Cold War before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So I think we need to be reconceiving, changing the narrative about what security is. And I think having suffered as we have through the pandemic, being at least in some circles so conscious of what this has revealed in terms of the inequalities and what inequality means in terms of life and death issues, security is about having confidence in your ability to live, to prosper, and for your children and grandchildren to do so.
Joseph, I'm going to give two more questions, and then I think it's time for us to bring this to this really interesting webinar to a close. So one question is, how do you see the Back from the Brink campaign? Is that helpful as a way to getting rid of nuclear weapons? And then the second question, unless we challenge the crazy and unproven belief that nuclear weapons are useful as a deterrent to force our adversaries to do what we want, we will not be able to get rid of these weapons. That is what our politicians believe and use as a justification for keeping nuclear weapons indefinitely. So could you respond to those two questions, please? And then we'll cut off the questions.
Sure. So I think the Back from the Brink campaign has been very helpful. It has five elements to it. I'm not sure I'm going to rattle them off, all of them, but basically it's to de-alert nuclear weapons, to cut spending for the new range of arsenals, for the new weapons and delivery systems, ultimately to support diplomacy leading to the abolition of nuclear weapons, a couple others in there as well. Initiated by Physicians for Social Responsibility. It's not unlike the freeze of the early 1980s. It seems ultimately fair. It seems responsible and what we need. And so you have a combination of initiatives here to promote it, to use it to put pressure on the Biden administration. So you have local communities which have adopted resolutions in city councils, but even the state legislature in California, I think one other state, have adopted it. And again, it serves as a way to formally put political pressure on the Biden administration, but also, in order to get your city council or your state legislature to adopt it, that means you've got to go out and educate about what the nuclear dangers are and why this provides a hopeful direction to go in and helps to build the movement we need to eliminate nuclear weapons. So I think it's really valuable. You can Google it online. You'll find all five elements of it, which I should have committed to more easily to memory. But it's I think a very good organizing and political force building process. In terms of deterrence, just to say that deterrence is very, very, very good until it ceases to work. There are no guarantees that it's going to work indefinitely. I mean, you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. You get to have political forces that are so great. I mean, remember at the height of the confrontation, President Kennedy says to his brother, if I hadn't responded with the blockade, I could have been impeached. You know, you have very powerful nationalist and other forces, we certainly have them here in the United States, which push in irrational ways. And again, looking at that crisis, Kennedy had promised the military that if the Russians didn't back down at one point within 48 hours, he would authorize an invasion. Unknown to Kennedy and to the US leaders was the Russians already had assembled a number of their nuclear weapons, including tactical nukes in Cuba. And so had that invasion gone forward, it would have escalated to nuclear war. There also is a new book by, I have it here. Yeah, there's a new book here by Marty Sherwin called Gambling with Armageddon, which begins with absolutely hair-raising description of the what was happening with the naval blockade in the Caribbean. And I'd written about this in Empire and the Bomb. Kennedy wanted there to be a period of calm for Khrushchev to consider an offer from the United States. But Kennedy did not have 100% control over the Navy. And so you had a situation where U.S. naval forces saw this is a great time to, in a real theater, to practice depth bombing and use of grenades against Soviet submarines. And so you had a situation where there was a Soviet submarine armed with nuclear-armed torpedoes. And the situation in that Russian, one of the Russian submarines became so severe that they thought the only way that they could maybe save their crew was to launch the nuclear weapons. Soviet doctrine at the time was that all three of the commanding officers had to approve the launch. Two of the three did, but the most senior of the three said no. And that's why we're alive and holding this webinar today. And you know, the danger is not only U.S. and Russia, U.S. and China. You think in terms of India and Pakistan, where in the last war, both countries exchanged nuclear threats. There have been these terrorist attacks on the Indian parliament in the past, where you had international pressure has limited the Indian response to the military response to those attacks. And so the Indians have adopted a policy called Cold Start. Another attack like that, and their military is off. It's invading Pakistan. Pakistan's nuclear doctrine, its weapons, are designed to basically wipe out the tank forces that would be coming across the border. With the United States, China, the United States and Russia principally leading the arms race, there's not great hope that we can de-escalate, say, the Indian-Pakistani nuclear confrontation without serious initiatives being taken before and kind of creating the environment between the United States and Russia. There's one last thing I want to say here. It's in its own way, it feels a little bit awkward to be dominating this conversation, to be the person to whom all the questions come. And I just want to appreciate that there are a number of people on this call who know as much as I do, maybe have specialized knowledge in different areas. And I just want to appreciate the wisdom that a lot of the people on this call have, and just to express my hope that people in the several states who are on this, will take the action to both educate, work in your local religious denomination, your city council, in your teachers union, whatever, to do the education and organizing we need, and to be doing it in a way that recognizes the interrelationship of nuclear weapons with military intervention, with climate, with economic justice, because we've got to work in an integrated way if we're actually going to build the power we need to win.
Thank you so much, Joseph. We didn't get to all the questions, but we got to a large percentage of them. And I think all of us are incredibly grateful to you for spending so much time with us today and giving us this great background information. And to everyone on this call, let's continue to do all that we can because the stakes are incredibly high. So thank you all very much and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Jean.
Thank you. Bye-bye.